I'm both. Okay. Okay. Today's our second class about King Solomon and the First Temple. So there's so much to learn, right? But I'm just going to start with a drop of a review because that's a very important principle. I'll say it in Hebrew and then translate it into English, but I've probably said it before to some of you. Halomed ve'eno chozer. I said it in Hebrew because it rhymes, right? The one who learns but doesn't review is like the one who plants but doesn't reap. So review is very important in learning. We're just going to do a quick review just to bring us back into this place. But certainly in deeper learning, it's very important to review to bring your learning deeper. Actually, okay, I'll bring that in a minute. All right, so King David is the father of King Solomon. King Solomon is the one that we're learning about. Let's just review their names for a minute. So that's the review. We're going a little bit deeper. So King Solomon's name is Shlomo, which I wrote in Hebrew on the page here, so that you can see that the root of Shlomo is Shalom. The root of Shalom is Shalem. When we talk about roots in Hebrew, it's important to think about what that means. You often hear roots and how roots connect. So a visual for me that works very nicely is hub and spokes. So the root is in the hub, and then all the different manifestations of that root are like spokes. But because they're all connected in the hub with the root, they all are connected to each other. So when we see a root, shin lamed mem, and we know that spokes from that are Shlomo, Shalom, Shalem, right, and maybe some other things too, but we know that they're all connected somehow. So King Solomon is connected to Shalom, which is connected to Shalem. Shalem is wholeness or completion, which is the root of Shalom. Not peace, but synergy, wholeness, everything working together. Mistranslated, because we don't really have a word for that in English as peace, but so much more than the absence of war, it's really things working together so nicely, which is what we hope for after the absence of war, right? So it's bringing it to the next level. And King Shlomo really was the hopeful embodiment of that, although, as we learned last time, he didn't quite get it. And so the kingdom was wrested away from him. But he was the one who was able to build the temple because his root was peace, is peace. Now, the root of King David is beloved. So David, we use the same, so David is his name. Put the Dalet, Vav, Dalet in the hub now and see the different spokes. You get David, the name. You get Dod, uncle, Doda, aunt. But also Dod, beloved, as in the verse in Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, that we're going to look at today. Dodi li v'ani l'dodi, right? You've all heard that before. You see it on wedding rings. I am to my beloved, my beloved is to me, and I am to my beloved. Right? Or my beloved is to me, and I am to my beloved. So Dod, that kind of Dod, is beloved. So David is beloved. And that's what we see principally in David's life stories, his belovedness, his true, tender connection with God that's so strong that through that connection he's able to produce the Psalms. And because of that connection of loving connection, like a beloved, that's why King Solomon, his son, gets to build the temple. And that's why the temple and the kingdom is not wrested away from Solomon himself, but rather from future generations, even though it is taken from him. And so I gave you that in last week's page, which I don't have another copy of. In the end of Kings, it says, God is saying to him, since you're guilty of this and have not kept my covenant and my laws, I will tear the kingdom away from you. But I will not do this in your time for the sake of your father, David. Instead, I will tear it away from your son. I will give your son one tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. So we see that a strong theme in David's life is belovedness, and the strong theme in Solomon's life is not actually peace, but wisdom, which we talked about last time. So that's the review, basically, going deeper for the review. So, interestingly, so a key trait is wisdom, which we talked about last time, and I promised you a story, which I found in the Ein Yaakov. Ein Yaakov, I'm just trying to think of all the different principles I want to bring in. An important principle, I believe, in Jewish education, in education altogether, is a principle that Rav Hirsch talks about in lighting the menorah. So when he talks about lighting the menorah, the word used in the Chumash is not to kindle, but to raise up the flame. It's a strange usage of a word to raise up the flame. And he says that that is the way a Jewish educator should educate, to hold the light next to the wick long enough that the wick can then take its own light, and then to pull back. So the Jewish educator's job is to stand there patiently until the wick is lit, and then to make themselves obsolete, pull themselves back, and empower the student to do their own learning. So that is my principle as an educator. So for that reason, I just want to show you this book, too, Ein Yaakov. This book is the Woman's Gemara. Why is it the Woman's Gemara? Women in general, in another discussion we won't go into today, in general, women don't learn Gemara. In general, it's not recommended for women to learn Gemara. Keep that as a question and wonder about it. Ask me some other time. But this is the Woman's Gemara. This is all the stories in the Gemara put into one book. So this is all the agadic aspects of Talmud. So Talmud is, it's interesting because Talmud is actually the feminine in relationship to the masculine, the written law, and yet women don't learn the Talmud. But this is all the stories in it. So Talmud is divided into law and stories. So the stories are in here. So the story that I wanted to find out, this was compiled by Avram, let's see, that's translations, by Yaakov ibn Chaviv. So Ibn means that he lived in Arabic lands instead of Ben, right? If he would be Shlomo ben David, who we're learning about, that means he lived in a place where they spoke Hebrew, whereas Yaakov ibn Chaviv, ibn is Arabic for Ben. It means he lived in Arabic-speaking lands. Anyway, so nicely in the index, I was looking for that story that I knew existed, so I just looked up Solomon and King of the Demons. So it's a long story, actually. But it's, how did this picture of legs get in here? Okay. It's a shoe ad. When I went to Yeshiva in Jerusalem.
Sorry. Yeah.
Oh, we had to let everybody know.
I'll tell you the story. So when I went to Yeshiva in Jerusalem, right, so I'm 16 years old and middle of high school, and I went for a year, and I came back like all frummed out, long sleeves, long skirts, saying Baruch Hashem, Mirtz Hashem all the time. And my high school friends freaked out, especially my closest friend. She's like, oh, she wrote me this whole long parable of a bird in a cage and how this bird taught the other bird with a broken wing how to fly and healed it. And now this bird that taught the other one how to fly is placing herself in a cage and constricting herself and, you know, with all these rules completely bound up. And now the other bird that learned how to fly from this bird is outside the cage wondering why won't she fly? So
she
oh my gosh, right? So when I went back for my second year in Israel, I had told her what it was like in the dorms and in the classroom, and the classroom was just in an apartment building. It was the dorms were the bedrooms, and the classroom was the living room. Bedroom was upstairs and the living room downstairs in just an apartment. And all the mail came into a shoebox for everybody. So she decides she's going on a one-woman campaign of keeping me from going way too overboard in the tznius department. And so she sent me postcards instead of letters with naked ladies on the front so that everybody would say I had to get the mail first every single day, run to the box to make sure there was no letter for me in there because I had to quickly go through it and spirit it away. Anyway. I am. Not close friends, because high school friends, but yep. We Facebook each other, we talk to each other once in a while. Yep. Susan Thompson, whose name is now Ishel Olivas. So when she changed her name to Ishel, I-X-E-L, and I said to my father, Ishel? He said, yes, Ishel. Ishel is friends with Aliza. My English name is Alisa. So he's just saying people change their name. And Ishel can be Ishel if Alisa can be Aliza. So, yes, I am friends with Ishel today. Okay, so the question is, should I read it all out loud? Do you want to hear it straight from the Gemara, the translation, or do you want to hear just the story? The story, okay. So King Solomon, as we said, he's got the wisdom, and part of his wisdom is the languages of other creatures. And he needs to build the temple, but he is told that in order to build the temple, he can't use, as we talked about last week, the Shemir Worm, he can't use any metal instruments. So this is back of that story. he asks the sages, so how am I supposed to build it? And they say, we don't know. Why don't you ask the demons? He says, the demons. They will know. And they said, yes, find a male demon and a female demon, tie them together, and when they get frustrated with each other, perhaps they'll tell you how to do it. So that's what he does. And this actually comes from a verse where it says, it's interesting, it refers to what they had, let's see, in Ecclesiastes, it just takes a verse here, I provided myself with sharim and sharot, and with every human luxury. So, and it refers to those human luxuries, shida and shidot. So, and so some people translate those as baths, pools and baths, but the word shade in Hebrew, and we don't usually pronounce that word, I'm just saying it for you to hear it, but it's just like the window variety, we sometimes pronounce it as a shindalad, because that's how it's spelled, but we don't actually say, unless we're talking about window shades, we don't usually say that word. Because it apparently gives power to that creature, that type of creature. So, but it sounds like it when it says they had shida and shidot, that it could be masculine of those creatures and feminine of those creatures, that there were many of them. So it is referring to them. In the book Derech Hashem, the Way of God, it talks about celestial creations, terrestrial creations, and in-between creations. So the terrestrial are all the stars and everything in the celestials, all the stars and everything in the heavens. Terrestrial is us, animals, plants, everything that's here. And then there's in-betweens. So in-betweens would be all the spiritual forces, positive and negative. We don't believe in demons like Christians believe in demons. We don't believe in the devil as an opposing force equal to God or that could thwart God or that needs power by buying souls. We don't believe in selling a soul. That comes from a Christian concept, and of course there is no like Christian concept. There's so many concepts in Christianity that there's like Christian concepts. You can't see that on the tape, but lots and lots and lots of different ones. I just don't want you to think that I'm generalizing and sweeping because there are so many different. So within Christianity, somewhere, and maybe in different sects together, but there is a concept of the devil needing energy in order to oppose God and therefore would want to purchase the soul of a human being or trade something for the soul of a human being in order to get the energy of that soul in order to increase its energy so it can oppose God better. We don't believe in anything like that at all whatsoever. We do talk about a Satan, which Satan, which can be translated or sometimes spoken about as the devil, has nothing to do with American Christian concepts at all whatsoever. Our concept of Satan is the concept of opposer, or just think about it as, let's say, in the army, the general of the obstacle course, right? The one whose job it is to oppose, to thwart, to make difficult for the sake of strengthening and empowering in the end. So to put huge boulders in your way, but only so you should be able to climb them and so that you should become stronger. So in Judaism, the Satan is considered an agent of God whose job it is to create difficulties in order to create stronger individuals or give us opportunities to become stronger. That's not the same category as these demons.
But it's not an element of evil.
No, not evil at all. Mm-mm. My understanding is, and I do not totally understand demons in Judaism, so I can't really comment, but my understanding is that evil basically can only be human. That the concept of evil is a construct. God made evil. This is a whole other talk, so I'm not going to go far into this. God made evil only so that human beings could choose. So that we could choose if we want good or evil, that we have internal strength and we can choose what we want to do with it. So we can choose to fly a plane to Haiti for rescues or choose to fly a plane into a building for terrorism. It's up to us. You know, but whether or not we can mine aluminum from the ground or figure out how to, I don't even know what aluminum is made out of, but does it come directly or not, but whether or not we can figure out how to make an airplane out of what's in the dirt, it's pretty amazing that human beings can just take dirt and somehow dig for what we need and fill teeth, make airplanes, build computers. I mean, like, look what we've done It's huge. And we can do positive and negative with everything that we do. Bless you. So the evil has to be there so that we can choose it, so that when we don't choose it, we are choosing good, so that free will matters, basically. So, but within that whole structure, so the whole world basically is here as an arena of choices for human beings. So in this entire world, there needs to be all kinds of things for us to be able to choose with and choose against, and choose in the midst of. So the sea is populated, the sky is populated, the heavens are populated, and spiritual space is populated too. So we see physical space populated. But physical space is a parable, and hopefully we'll talk about parables today, is really a parable for spiritual space. So everything that we see physically is supposed to help us understand something spiritually. So for instance, if you look under a microscope at your hand, a good enough microscope, you'll see bugs teeming all over. It will totally creep you out, right? You'll never lick your fingers again because you're eating colonies of bugs when you do, right? It's disgusting what's all over us. And yet we can live with it because we can't see it. So, and it's better not to see it and not be so grossed out, right? Because I see some wrinkled noses. So it is gross if you see it, but it's not if you just live with it, right? But now we know at least enough about germ theory or something, and I'm not equating germs to the bugs. There are little tiny bugs, too. But we know enough about germs to know that germs can infect us and harm us. Some germs do, some germs don't, some to different levels. So, and we can see some of them, I think. I don't know if we can see germs or not, but we can see all kinds of bacteria and things that harm us or don't harm us. So that we can see them is in order to help us understand that there are spiritual things too, teeming everywhere. Some can harm us a lot, a little, depending on how we put up defense shields and put them down. So with germs, you can wash your hands with soap, warm water, scrubbing, streaming, careful with the towels, all that stuff. And with spiritual agents, one can do spiritual things to protect themselves. So that would include speaking carefully, being kind, giving tzedakah, dressing appropriately, eating the right foods, judging people with the benefit of the doubt, giving the benefit of the doubt. There are all kinds of spiritual procedures one can go through to protect themselves from spiritual negativity and to open themselves up to spiritual positivity. So we have a spiritual immune system that can be harmed and can be strengthened through our behavior. So you can take that for however you want to take it for now. Store that piece of information too. Anyway, in this population of our worlds, we have the celestial things. The heavens are populated, the earth is populated, and in between there are spiritual forces. Human beings are the only ones made up of two forces where physical and spiritual blended into one. Everything else is either physical or spiritual. We're the only ones that are a mix of the two. You'll have to ask in a different class about animals, but they're different. Okay, meanwhile, Solomon now needs to figure out how to build this temple. So he does find, somehow, he sends his messengers off to find a male demon and a female demon. He binds them together, and they don't like being bound together, and they say, we don't know. They tell the truth for some reason. We don't know, but perhaps the king of the demons knows. Go to, and his name is Ashmedai. So I wrote it on your paper so you could see it. Did I write it? Yeah. Ashmedai. Right, in Ein Yaakov, so that's the name of the book, and the story is about Ashmedai. So he goes to find Ashmedai. Now, how is he going to find him? He's the king of the demons. He's really smart. So what does he do? He goes with a ring that has God's name on it, and he goes with a chain that has God's name on it. Bless you. So he sends his messenger to go find him with a ring and the chain that has God's name on it. And we'll talk about God's name in a minute. So we have God's name on the ring and the chain, and now the messenger has to go. Turns out that the king of the demons every night goes up to the heavenly yeshiva, learns Torah, and then every day comes down to earth and learns Torah in the earthly yeshiva. And when he gets thirsty, he goes to his well and drinks. But he wants to make sure he won't get poisoned. So his well has a stone over it with a seal. And every time before he drinks, he checks the seal to make sure that the well has not been tampered with. So the question is, how do you get to this guy? How are we going to capture him to give the information? Because he's not easily captured, and you have to figure it out. So Solomon sends his servant. His servant digs a hole under the well, in the mountain, under the well to drain the well of its water. And then he stuffs the hole full of fleeces that he bought. And then he goes above the well to the top above on the mountain above the cistern, he digs another hole and he fills the well with wine. And then he patches up both spots so it doesn't look like the ground was tampered with. Then when the demon comes down from the heavens, he checks the seal. He sees that it's intact. He moves the stone aside and he smells the wine. And he says, wait a second, there's wine in here. Now there's a concept that when wine goes in, secrets come out. So he knows he shouldn't touch the wine. Interesting, speaking of our hub and spoke model, wine and secrets have the same numerical value. That works with gematrias, work together that way too. If a name, if a word has a numerical value, that's also a hub. And other words with the same numerical value are spokes. So wine and secrets have the same value. So when wine goes in, secrets come out. So he smells the wine, he says, ah, I'm not going to have it. But he's thinking, but the seal was intact. Strange. But as his thirst overpowers him, he does drink from the wine. Drinks from the wine and falls asleep. And that's when they're able to put the chain around his neck that has the name of God on it. When he wakes up, he feels the chain, and he wants to struggle from it. But Solomon's servant says, don't struggle away from the chain. It has the name of God on it. Meaning, if you break the chain, you will desecrate the name of God because you'll break apart his name. So this, I mean, think about us today. We're careful not to throw away a piece of paper that has the name of God on it. You know, if we, let's say we photocopy something sideways, right? And so you're not handing it out to the class. It's just going in the garbage, but it doesn't go in the garbage. It goes in a special pile to be buried because it has the name of God on it. And any photocopy that you get in the class that you don't want, leave in the office because it'll go for burial instead of just being scattered where it shouldn't be. But the name of God isn't supposed to be desecrated, so we take careful care of it. So this demon also knew his master's name was on his neck. He couldn't break the chain, and so he was forced to stay in the chain. So they take him to Jerusalem, where Solomon is, and Solomon doesn't see him for 3 days. It's a whole mystical thing, and I do not understand the story at all. I'm just telling you what I read. So the first day, he's in prison waiting to see Solomon. He says, how come Solomon doesn't want to see me? And they answer him, because you drank too much. So the demon takes a brick and puts it on a pile of bricks. They go back to Solomon and say, he took a brick and put it on a pile of bricks. And he said, by that, he means you're giving him too much to drink. So the next day, they go back to him, and they say, and he says, how come Solomon doesn't want to see me? He says, it's because you eat too much. So he takes a brick, and he puts it on the side of the pile. And they go back to him and say, you put a brick on the side of the pile. He says, it's because you're not giving him enough food. So they give him more food. And then the third day, he sees him. On the third day, Solomon, this person full of wisdom, says to him, and this is why, for sure, I don't understand this, says to him, what makes you better than humans? I don't understand it. I see why angels are on a higher level than humans, but why are demons? And he says, let's see, maybe that's a little bit later in the story. I think that's the second question. Okay, skip that. He says, how are we going to do this worm thing? So now reinsert the story I told you last week about the worm. Okay, so he tells him that the wild hen knows where it is. He's promised to the servant of the sea that he's not going to tell. And so they figure out how to find the wild hen. They trick him with a glass bowl on top of the nest. She brings the shamir worm. The shamir worm goes through the glass. The servant of Solomon yells, takes the worm away, brings it to the temple. The temple is built. And then, he keeps the demon in chains, though, during the entire building of the temple. It's towards the end of that he says, how are you guys better than us? And he says, take off the chain and give me the ring with your name in it, and I'll tell you. Well, that was a mistake. Anybody who's smart should know not to give the signet ring with the name of God to a demon, but he does. So then apparently he spreads out his wings. One touches the heavens and one touches the earth. And with one of them, he whaps Solomon and sends him hundreds of miles away out of his kingdom. And then he shapeshifts into Solomon's shape and sits on the throne. So now Solomon is wandering in exile, and he's trying to tell people, I'm the king, and nobody believes him because the king is on the throne, and they think he's a nut. So he's wandering, he's in exile, not just in physical exile, though, but also in personality exile, because he can't even claim who he is. Nobody recognizes him, and there is no alternate personality for him to take. He can't be just a peasant somewhere. He has to reclaim his throne. So I think it takes 3 years for him to go back and reclaim the throne. But he is saying in the different places that he goes, and people think that he's just crazy, I'm the king. And they say, you couldn't be, he's on the throne. But he keeps saying it, and he keeps saying it. And even though I think it was Einstein that said that the definition of crazy is to keep doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results, right? So, but he kept saying the same thing over and over, hoping for different results. In fact, he got them. Because they finally said, wait a second, a crazy person has different delusions, not the same consistent delusion for so long. It must be that he's not crazy. It must be that we should be asking some more questions here. So they go and ask the king's advisors, have you gotten any directions from the king lately? And they said, actually not. The king has not instructed us to do anything for quite some time. Then they went to the king's wives and said, has the king, remember there's 1,000 of them. So they said, has the king visited you? And they said, yes, but during our time of separation, meaning when they were in Nida, the time that a king shouldn't be visiting his wife, right? Visiting meaning having relations. So they said to the wives, please examine his feet when he comes. Now a demon can shapeshift, except for his feet, which it turns out will be in the shape of a rooster's feet. So they said he always comes with slippers or socks. And they said, really? So somehow they caught him, and King Solomon got his throne back. And the demon was able to fly away, though, not fully grounded and not fully subdued. So apparently he's still on the loose.
With his rooster feet.
And his ability to shapeshift. Yes.
Why was the demon studying yeshiva?
Why was he going in the yeshiva? Well, because the demon is a servant of God. Right? So that's why I'm saying, that's why I wanted to preface it with, he's not evil, although I don't really understand. Look, does he have free will? Not free will. Angels do not have free will. Do demons have free will or not? I would doubt it, but I don't know enough about demons to be able to tell you about their character. But they're definitely servants of God. That I know for sure. God runs everything and everything underneath. So there's many different servants. So cancer is a servant of God, and so is chemotherapy, right? They both serve God. The question is, what results does God want? The person's death, the person's suffering, or the person's healing? And for a person, there's different results that are needed in each case. So all the different servants act in different ways. Is it just that we categorize the negative, what appears to us to be negative servants as demons and the positive servants as angels? I'm not sure of that answer. Or so is it our perception that categorizes them separately? Or is it their actual reality? Those are things that are way beyond what I know or what we actually need to know in order to function in this world. But it is interesting to know that there are different things out there that make things happen. So why was he studying? Because servants of God study Torah. That is what it is. So that's what I want to say. One thing that I learned in here as I was reading, there's another story about how opposites work on this earth. So opposites work in terms of learning. So it said in regular situations, full things can't hold any more because they're full. And empty things can be filled up. But it's just the opposite when you're learning Torah. The more full you are, the more you can hold. And the more empty you are, the less you can hold. Meaning the more Torah you learn, the more Torah you can learn. There is no limit to what you can learn and absorb. But the less you know, or the less you care about knowing, the less you can hold, because there is nothing for it to take hold to. So that one has to learn, and that's a tricky place. How do you get to learn something so you can learn something? It can happen in youth, but I think it can happen through today for sure, different pathways of curiosity and care. But if you know nothing, you can't learn anything. If you're an empty vessel, so maybe you have to fill yourself up with, we also have a statement in Pirkei Avot, Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. Derech Eretz can be translated in a lot of different ways, but in this particular place, it would be translated as manners or appropriate physical behavior. So it's possible that one would have to fill themselves up first with appropriateness in how they deal with people, with self, people, family, possessions, and a proper way of dealing with things, and then that would create a vessel that could hold Torah, and then that could be filled and then filled even more. But somebody who's empty can't hold Torah. So I just thought it was an interesting thing. That's just one of the extra, there's all kinds of stuff in here that's interesting. Okay, let's move on from that. Do you have another question on that before we move on? Everybody completely understands every nuance of the... Okay, good.
Now, did the fabulous. Did the demon do any... did he run? Was he a good king? Was he a bad king?
That's a good question. I don't know enough about what the demon did while he was on the throne.
Years.
He must have been fine because they didn't suspect from his leadership that he wasn't the king.
So he wasn't evil
right.
in that sense.
Right, right. Because the question did not arise because of the way he behaved on the throne.
So
the question
evil?
Arose because of this crazy person that kept saying that he was the king.
But he was evil by swatting Solomon, you know.
So was he evil by swatting Solomon or not? Is a good question. Because evil would mean is going against the will of God. And in this case, we talked about last week, Solomon had some problems. Mm. Too many wives and too many horses and too much money. Mm. And so it's possible he needed exile. Mm. Exile is a concept atones. So exile atones for many things. When somebody needs to experience death or illness or poverty, exile can atone for those things because exile really is that. If you're taken away from your land, taken away from your possessions, taken away from your identity, so then you are, in a way, experiencing death or poverty or illness or you're bereft of things. That's what exile does. And so some of the early Hasidic rabbis and throughout Jewish history, people put themselves voluntarily into exile for atonement purposes or for regrounding purposes. But we also understand that the Jewish people have been placed into exile for atonement and for the learning that it brings. And part of what it can bring is getting into touch with who you actually are and not the perceptions of who you are. Not your own personal perceptions and not others' perceptions of who you are. Because when you're in exile going from place to place and people don't know you and you don't know yourself so much or you can't rely on familiar cues for who you are, you have to really figure out, well, what makes me... me. And that is part of what this long exile of the Jewish people has done for us, is we have to wander, 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 and understand that our only real foothold is in Torah. That's the only thing that's kept us together for 2,000 years. And anybody who leaves that is no longer part of the stream of Jews who are wandering. Right? You could leave it for a couple generations, but if you don't come back, then you're just no longer part of the Jewish people. You wander away, far enough away, that you're not part of the stream of the wandering Jews. But in the wandering, it's our constant quest. Who are we? How do we define ourselves? How will we ground ourselves? How will we measure ourselves? Where do we want to head? So exile can accomplish that. So was it bad for him to be in exile? Maybe not. Maybe not.
Come back and was he a better king?
Right, so then there's discussion of did he come back as a commoner, meaning in terms of mentality, or did he come back as just as powerful a king or more powerful a king? And of course, when there's two Jews, there's three opinions. So there's conversation about that. So I don't know if we reached a conclusion, but there is conversation about that.
Why are the stories for the women and the law for the men is kind of what you were implying by that this is the Gemara for women.
Right.
It's the story.
Right, hang on to that for just a second. Do you have a question?
Did the demon ever give away the secret of the worm?
Mm-hmm. Mm. He said that the wild hen holds the secret and where to find her.
Okay.
And then they had to figure it out from there. But at least gave them the clue on how to get there. Why is it the stories are for the women? So, again, it's a whole long talk, and I'm trying to think what time is it? I didn't bring my watch.
12.
Okay, so you'll have to ask me another time. It's a very good question, and I could give you an answer, but I want to get to some more of this. So just hold on to it and ask another time. Okay. All right, so we talked about the story. Now, Solomon's crowning achievement, the main thing in his life to remember is that he built the temple. Right, but he also wrote three books. He was the author of three books, which we didn't talk about last time. So he wrote Kohelet, which in English is Ecclesiastes, Mishle, which is Proverbs, and Shir HaShirim, Song of Songs, or Song of Solomon. So these three books, it's a question when he wrote each one, and there's even some questions as to authorship, but basically it's agreed that he wrote these three. And it's interesting how they each start. So the basic agreement is he wrote Qohelet first. And the reason, the way that they figure it out is by the first verse of each one. So the first verse of Qohelet is, the words of Qohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem. That's the authorship. Right? So in this authorship, his name isn't there. Now, we do have a thing in Judaism, or in Jewish authorship, where sometimes books are named after the author, and sometimes the author is named after his book. For instance, the Chafetz Chaim, right? We've all heard of the Chafetz Chaim, the one who wrote the book on how to guard your tongue. But his name was Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. But after he wrote his book, the Chafetz Chaim, which he named after a verse, who desires life? Who is Chafetz Chaim, who desires life? The one who guards his tongue. So he writes a book as a guide to the desirer of life. How do you guard your tongue? But there is that verse in Psalms, who desires life? The one who guards his tongue. So, but now he's known as the Chafetz Chaim. Nobody calls him Rabbi Kagan anymore. And our Rabbi Kagan of this yeshiva is actually the same name, Yisrael Meir Kagan. But this is a different Yisrael Meir Kagan. Nobody calls him Rabbi, nobody refers to him as Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. Everybody calls him the Chafetz Chaim, after his book. Occasionally, he's called the Mishneh Brura, because he also wrote a commentary on the Shulchan Aruch called the Mishneh Brura. So he's occasionally named, he's also referred to as that. Sometimes people write books, and then they name their book after themselves or after their teacher. So it might, a book, maybe somebody's name is David, and the book that they write will be called the Or David, the Light of David, right? That happens too. Anyway, so King Shlomo is sometimes called Qohelet. He writes this book, his name is not in it, but he is sometimes actually referred to as Qohelet. But usually we call him King Shlomo. Anyway, so this is the first verse is, the words of Qohelet, son of David, king in Jerusalem. So his name isn't in it because he's not known. It's his first book, he's an unknown author, so he has to identify himself by his father, who everybody knows. But in case not everybody knows who he is, he's the king of Jerusalem, king in Jerusalem. So now everybody knows. Okay, so that's book number one. But book number two starts out, the Proverbs of Solomon, the son of David, king of Israel. So now we have his name in the book. So this is maybe he has his own knowledge a little bit. People know who he is. So these are the Proverbs of Solomon, son of David. But Shir HaShirim, his third book, and the most mystical, which I'll tell you about in a minute, is just, it starts off with Shir HaShirim Asher LaShlomo, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. Everybody knows who Solomon is, doesn't have to say King Solomon, doesn't have to say where. Everybody's heard of him by the time this book comes out. So that's how they figure out who, when he, what's the order of the books that he wrote. The first two books, Qohelet, which is read during the Festival of Sukkot, is about, that's the one where it says vanity, vanities, everything is vanities, right? So the whole, that's the theme of the book, basically, is that this world is vanity, meaning this world is fleeting. And whatever you attempt to accomplish in this world for sure will come to an end because we all do. And all created stuff comes to an end. Everything that God made comes to an end, except God. The only thing that doesn't have a beginning or an end, the only thing that isn't limited is God. And so anything we do in this world that we think will be permanent is not and can't be. The only thing that we can do in this world that is permanent is create a relationship with God. And the closer we get to God, the more permanent we will become. So the more, in a way, we sublimate ourselves to the will of the Creator, the Eternal One, the more we nullify our will for His will, the more we achieve eternality. So it's kind of a paradox that the less individual we are, the more permanent we are. And the more we try to create permanence in edifices here, the less we can achieve connection with God, and the less permanent we'll be. So there is that paradox. So that's basically what the whole book of Ecclesiastes is about, and said in many different ways. So first he lays down a foundation of this world is vain. You have to know how to use it so that it won't be. So if you just use it for acquiring stuff, acquiring a name, acquiring wealth, now it's interesting that he who acquired the wives, the horses, and the wealth wrote that book. So he really was, in a way, writing to himself, but to all of us. But that's what he wanted to say, is that the acquisition of stuff is pointless. You're going to die and go to the grave without any of it. And so try to acquire stuff that you'll be able to bring with you. And what you can bring with you is relationships. But you can't bring stuff. So what you try to create, your connection to God and your connection to others and your impact on others, that is permanent. But nothing else is. Then we move into the book of parables, Proverbs. So Mishle is Proverbs. And they all, each sentence in it, almost the whole book, has sentences of opposite. Let's see. Or the sentences might be divided up into different verses, but they all, they're very enigmatic. Like, here's just an example, and I can't say I understand this book at all. Drink water from your own cistern and running water from your own spring. May your springs spread rivulets of water in the squares. You alone shall have them, and strangers shall have nothing with you. Your fountain shall be blessed, and you shall rejoice with the wife of your youth. A lovely hind and graceful mountain goat. Her breasts will satisfy you at all times, and you shall always be intoxicated with her love. That's Mishle. I'm interested that they translated that. It's interesting. There's so much stuff, and so there are little, we quote from this, and some of the quotes are ones that we hear regularly, like, for instance, educate the youth according to his way, so that when he ages, he won't turn away from it. So there's lots of conversation. That's like the standard phrase in childhood education. Educate a youth according to his way. What is according to his way? Not according to your way, according to his way. You have to understand his way. Is it a Montessori method? Isn't it a Montessori method? All these different things. And if you do that, then they won't leave it in their old age. But if you don't do that, then they might leave it in their old age. So anyway, that's the book of Mishle, which is Proverbs, which we'll talk about in a second. But going to the third book is in a way, a whole proverb, or in this case, parable, Shir HaShirim. Shir HaShirim is all about lovers. And the whole thing is a very graphic, sensual description of a man and his wife. And it talks about the shape of her body and the beauty of her form and the color of her hair and the glossiness of her lips. And look, the whole thing is very sensual from start to finish. And it's considered the holiest book in the whole Tanakh. So why, let me just ask you, why do you think it's the holiest book if it's so sensual? So it's the relationship of humans to God, but why so sensual?
Because it's an intimate, something very intimate.
Good, good. It's a very, very intimate relationship. Excellent.
Excellent.
Right.
It's not comparable to any other act.
Right. So the actual physical act, the marital act, when done appropriately between husband and wife at the right time with the right intentions, meaning loving, joyous, passionate intentions. They don't have to be holy. The holy intentions are passion, love, joy, giving to this other person, your spouse, in joy and passion. It's supposed to be very passionate, as much as you will enjoy it being. When that occurs, the actual presence of God is brought down into this earth. It does bring it down. So that act of intimacy is the most bonding act that human beings can engage in, and it is the act of bonding the Shekhinah, the presence of God, to humanity also. And so this parable of Shir HaShirim, of this very sensual relationship, is all about our relationship with God. So it's all about, we are all, humanity is considered like the bride, and God is considered like the groom. So we're all, human beings are considered in the feminine in this case, and God in the masculine in this case. Of course, God is not masculine or feminine. God is God, and is like more an it with a capital I than, you know, a him or a her. But we do talk about energies that we see manifest. So just store this away for the answer for part of this, but your other question, but won't answer. It's just a piece of information to understand. An energy of masculinity is the energy of giving. And an energy of femininity is the energy of receiving and transforming and making manifest. So, for instance, and that doesn't mean men and women. All people have feminine. All people have masculine. Most women have predominantly feminine. Most men have predominantly masculine. All of us have both. Some are balanced, and some women are more masculine, and some men are more feminine. And I don't mean effeminate or masculine, I mean in these energies. So let's just take those energies and bring them into something that's not male or female, Torah. Okay? So I mentioned before that the written Torah is considered masculine, and the feminine Torah is the oral Torah is considered feminine. So in that case, there's a giving and receiving and making manifest. So the written Torah is basically in headlines, as you've seen. There's definitely stories in it, but a lot of times it's not even stories, or it'll say, do this as I have shown you, or it talks about marriage and, let's say, adultery. So how do you know adultery? When is somebody being adulterous? If they're married and they have a relationship with somebody that they're not married to, then that's adulterous. But how do you know when married is? We all know chuppah, ring, ketubah. We've seen it a million times, right? Several times, right? So we know that's how you get married, but it doesn't say that anywhere in the Torah. Where does it say marriage canopy? Where does it say ring? Where does it say contract? Where does it say what's in the contract? Nowhere in the five books of Moses. But it does say it in the oral law. Where does it say how to get divorced? Right? So at what point is that relationship, how is the relationship made contractually? And at what point is somebody out of that relationship? What about a get? Right? So we know about gets, but nowhere in the five books of Moses does it discuss a get, but the oral law talks about it. So the five books of Moses is considered masculine in that it gives the ideas, but you can't live from it. So I never read, but it would be interesting to read the guy, the one, Living Biblically, I think it's called, a guy who tried to spend a year living according to the Bible. Not possible if you don't have the oral explanation, right? Do you just not boil a kid in its mother's milk? Mm-hmm. Any mother's milk? Mothers of that species? Like what, right? Boil, not braise? I mean, like how do you, right? Mm-hmm. How do you define all of that? You have to have an oral law to define. So the oral law is what takes the ideas, the inspiration of the written law, and expands on them. That's why the written law is in here, right? And the oral law takes a whole bookshelf, right? Because and the oral law isn't even the whole oral law. The Talmud is just the container for the oral law. Meaning, when you use the words that are in those books, it permits the transference of oral law from teacher to student. So I'll give you a for instance of what I mean. The oral law, the Talmud opens up with, from when do we read Kriyat Shema? From the time the Kohanim go in to eat their truma. So now you tell me, a question was asked and answered. From when do we read Kriyat Shema? Well, how do you know that? From that question and answer, you can't know, right? That question and answer allows a teacher to sit with a student and say, this is what Kriyat Shema, this is what we mean by Kriyat Shema. These are who the Kohanim are. This is what Truma is. This is when they eat it and under what circumstances they eat it. Now that you know what Kriyat Shema is and who the Kohanim are and what Truma is and when they eat it, now you can say, from when do we read it? From that time that they do that. But if you would just be reading it, it wouldn't help you at all, right? So it's not that the Talmud is the oral law. The Talmud is the container for the oral law. So, but that's considered feminine because it's expansion. It's receiving and expanding and then eventually allowing to be made manifest. That's the feminine energy, is the ability to receive, expand, and make manifest. So if you think about father, mother, baby, so father gives inspiration very fast. An idea is transferred over very quickly in the sexual act, right? So a one-cell contribution is made, right, to somebody who receives it. And expands on it, and expands on it, and expands on it, sometimes uncomfortably for 9 months, right? And then there's synergy, right? What comes out as a baby that's not the masculine energy and is not the feminine energy is the combination and more of both than what either one gave, right? So it's masculine-feminine synergy. We see that all the time as a theme. That information is necessary to explain the other answer, which I'm not going to explain right now. Okay. But anyway, why did we start saying that? Oh, yeah. So God is masculine and humankind are feminine. God gives us the ability. God gives us stuff in the dirt, brains in our head. So that's the masculine gift. The feminine ability of humankind is to be able to take brain and earth and make it into buildings and computers and cell phones, right? That we can transform it. We can receive the gift, transform and make manifest. That's the feminine energy. So, what time is it now? I see some people getting ready to go. Sorry. Okay, good. Oh, I took my glasses off. Anybody has to go, go. Okay. So the Song of Songs is the third book that he writes, and that's all about a parable. Human relationships are a parable for our personal relationship with God. And the strongest relationship that there is the parallel relationship, not the top-down relationship, not king-subject, not parent-child, but lovers, the parallel relationship, where we're both in it of our own free will, and the relationship is only as good as the free will that maintains the relationship. King-subject, no free will required there. Parent-child, not there either. You're still in a relationship whether or not you feel like being in it. But lovers are only in the relationship as long as they both choose. And so it's the strongest relationship and the relationship of parallel people rather than top-down. And that is the relationship that we should aspire to create with God. A relationship, obviously, we're not parallel to God, but a relationship based on mutual free will where there's intimate knowledge that is the parable of the sexual relationship allows us to experience what that level of deep knowledge and knowing could be with the divine. And so that's Shir HaShirim, the holiest of books, which can give us a doorway into seeing that. Moving very quickly forward, I wanted to discuss the temple. The temple is a parable. And that's why I think it's important that his book, one of his middle book is Parables, Proverbs, but Parables. The temple itself is a parable for our relationship with God. All sacrifices are parables. God, of course, does not need a sacrifice. What does he care if you bring him a goat or not, really? It's all about us. It's all about how can we engage in something physical that brings us to a spiritual place. So we human beings are physical. We're created as physical. We need physical stuff to do to move us to places spiritual. So when we sacrifice, each animal that is sacrificed is a parable for some aspect of humankind. Goats are brazen and they jump around. Their energy is not so controlled. Sheep follow. Oxes are strong. Each one has its own aspect to it. Doves are faithful. So different things that are offered, and that's just one stream. I don't fully understand korbanot either. But when we talk about sacrifices, it's the wrong word, which is why I wrote the word down here. So look down on your page for korbanot, thinking about our hub and spokes again. The hub of the word korban, the root, is karov. Kuf, resh, bet. That root means close. So a krov is also a relative. Karov is close, like in space or in time. Korban is another spoke from that hub. Korban, properly translated, would not be sacrifice or offering, but really would be close maker. Because that's really what a korban does. It's something that makes us closer to God. So, in a way, it's like bringing a cup of coffee to your spouse or good friend in the cup that they like the best, the temperature that you know they like, with the amount of milk and the type of milk. What kind of fat milk do they like, right? How strong do they like the coffee? Do they like it brewed? Do they like it instant? What type do they like, right? Knowing all that about this person and bringing them that cup of coffee is an act of close making. It's an act of saying, I know something about you, and I know things that are important to you, and I'm making a gesture towards you to say I noticed it, and I appreciate it, and I'm extending myself to say that I recognize you and your humanity in bringing you this. So a korban, properly understood, has nothing to do with us sacrificing something for God. Although, when you bring that cup of coffee, are you sacrificing? It's not a sacrifice, but it does take your time and your energy and your thought to put it together, right? But it's an act of close making. That's what korbanot are about, although it's much broader than that as well. It has to do with the act of eating also, and eating is about integration of body and soul, keeping them together. That there's mystical things about the world eating, but really it has to do, just like humans eating, keeping together body and soul, the spiritual essence of the world with the physical essence of the world can be held together by human beings acting in a way that feeds that, not food that it needs to eat, but that we engage in acts that bring spiritual and physical together personally and then in a planetary way. So all that happens in the temple. We know that the temple is not really about the temple, it's about us because of the way it's first described in the desert. So when God says, build for me a tabernacle, he says, build me a tabernacle and I will dwell among you, not in it. Right? So the act of each one of us engaging in building that tabernacle means that each one of us builds a space inside of us in which God can dwell. So build for me this edifice and I will dwell among you. So it's not the temple. It's not like God's home, although we talk about it that way. So we have to constantly remind ourselves what's a parable and what do we learn from that parable. So when we say a house of worship is a place of worship or a place where God dwells, that is a parable. Of course God doesn't dwell there, and yet God does dwell there. But what does that mean? It doesn't mean God has a home where he's stuck in that place or where his presence is even more concentrated in that place. But it's all a parable for accessibility and how we see God and how we relate to it. So it all needs to be expanded in our lives so that we can take the sentence of the parable, whether the sentence is house of worship or educate your child according to its way or build a temple or whatever it is, and expand it into trying to understand what that means for us. That being said, moving quickly forward, in Pirkei Avot, the fifth chapter in the fifth Mishnah, it lists 10 miracles that existed in the first temple. And we're just going to read through them quickly and not be able to discuss them, really. But just so you should know, this is what was going on in the first temple. These miracles did not reappear, by the way, in the second temple, which was considered to be on the lower level. 10 miracles were performed in the temple. No woman ever miscarried because of the smell of the holy meat. So the smell, if you've ever been in a slaughterhouse, it really stinks. Here they're slaughtering animals all day long. It did not stink bad enough to make a woman miscarry. Never had that ugly a smell. The holy meat never spoiled. Never was a fly seen in the slaughterhouse. Never did the high priest have an accidental seminal discharge on Yom Kippur, which would have made him unavailable for service that day. The rains did not extinguish the wood fire burning upon the altar. The wind did not prevail over the column of smoke that rose in a straight column from the altar, so the wind never could blow it away. It always rose straight, even if it was a windy day. No disqualifying problem was ever discovered in the Omer offering, the two loaves, or the showbread. So these particular offerings, they never found something that would disqualify them. When people would come to the Beit HaMikdash, and people would come by the thousands or hundreds of thousands on the holidays, the three holidays, they stood crowded but had ample space in which to prostrate themselves. So I'm sure you've seen on Yom Kippur in some congregations during the Aleinu prayer, which is said quite a few times during the day, some people fully go down onto the ground. They don't just do the regular year-round this. They really go down onto their knees and all the way put their foreheads down onto the ground. So in the temple, that's how people did it. But the temple was so crowded, so many people were there, that everybody stood and davened like this, crowded like in a subway. And yet there was enough room for each person to personally prostrate themselves. So there was like a magic, a spiritual magic that happened, that they stood crowded, but there was enough space for that laying out of themselves during that time. Never did a snake or scorpion cause injury in Jerusalem during that time. And no man ever said to his fellow, "My lodging in Jerusalem is too cramped for me." Think about Jews. This is probably the biggest miracle of them all, because it doesn't say that there was enough room for everybody. It says nobody complained. How amazing is that? Like, everybody's visiting their relatives, and nobody complained about the lodging. So that was a huge miracle. I think I was just reading today that there's probably two more important miracles, which we'll talk in just 1 minute. But we have to just close this very quickly. So Solomon's major mistakes, too many wives, horses, gold, and silver. His career was jeopardized strongly by Pharaoh's daughter. This is a famous story of him, Pharaoh's daughter, one of the wives that did turn to foreign worship. She actually, he slept with her the night before the day of the dedication of the temple. And she caused him to oversleep. So there the whole crowd is waiting to dedicate that temple. And there he is, sleeping late. And his mother has to go wake him up and admonish him for sleeping late on the job. And that's what you get from too many wives, because you'll sleep late. There's an interesting story. I wish I could comment more. There's an interesting story in National Geographic, I think, this month on polygamy in America. Another discussion for it to talk about the polygamy. But the first temple was destroyed in 586 BCE. And the two miracles that I just wanted to mention that are still there is that the wall, which is not Solomon's wall, but that the temple spot was so important that the retaining wall that King Herod built to enlarge the Temple Mount area to build the second temple on, to build the new and improved second temple on, is still a wall that's visited. It's a miracle, actually, that today we identify ourselves with the same people who were there sacrificing at that temple, building that temple. We're the same group. If you think about it, it's a huge miracle that that wall is still standing and that we still care so long after the fact, that we're still today learning and identifying with the same people, the same things, the same yearning, the same learning, the same books, the same things in yeshivas. And it's a question what they learn in yeshivas. It's interesting. But that we are still identifying, that we do still care, that each person in this room is really a miracle of survival, of choice in physical survival and spiritual survival, that you made it from then until now, and you're here. So that's the end of the miracles of the first temple, and Rabbi Wasserman will take it from here.